Well, thank you very much, Dave, and a great pleasure to see all of you today. And I just told Dave, I'm sure glad he and I don't have to prepare dinner for all of you here or lunch. So great crowd and lots of opinions, lots of discussion going on. We heard earlier Jackie say on the earlier panel here that with regard to USDA, if you give them junk, you'll get junk back. Well, that's actually not quite true, because USDA tracks biases of farmers in surveys, and so they kind of have an idea of what the bias you're going to have. Now, an example of that is out when you're in the August crop report and they're trying to assess what yields are going to be. One of the things they find is that, wisely, most of you are pretty conservative. You know, this is still August. You're very concerned that maybe those yields really won't come in. And so farmers tend to underreport their yields. They don't believe that's anything intentional, but it is because they have tracked that bias over time. You're just trying to be, you know, conservative, and you don't want to get those hopes or anticipations up too high. So I thought about that a bit, junk in, junk out. Well, actually, USDA, in at least some of these cases, not that it's junk, but they do look at biases and to see if they actually correct for those things then. A couple other things I thought about when we heard the discussion on land values, which were all kind of mouths open thinking about these land values. But being an old marketing guy over all the years, you know, I always remember the adage that the markets always peak on an up day. It's always a day when, you know, you call your broker and you say, should I sell corn at $8 today? And there's just a hush on the phone. And the broker says, well, you know, you could if you only want $8, but our analysts are now saying 10 to 15 by summer. Okay? And, you know, we look back and we say, oh, my gosh, that was near the peak. Well, guess what? Everybody is bullish when it gets up near the high. Then another thing on land values, just to let you know, there's lots of different opinions around the room here today that, you know, I've studied land values pretty extensively, especially the history of land values. And one of the things I've noticed is that when you have a major decrease in land values, farmland values in the United States, those major decreases are always preceded by another event. And what is that? A major increase in land values. So as the old adage goes, all you have to do in marketing is get three things right: timing, timing, timing. So when you know it's the high, let me know also, so you and I can do well. Well, Dave asked me to talk a little bit about this issue of the problems USDA has been having and all of us as analysts have been having in trying to get the numbers right, as you heard discussed this morning. And specifically, the numbers that we want to talk just a little bit with you about is the feed usage, because with that feed usage, we also have what we call the residual. Now, the feed usage, as you know, is not measured, as you certainly have heard discussion this morning with the panels. And this came about because our livestock traditionally was raised across the country, but especially here in the Midwest, on family farms that provided their own corn that went into the corn crib or into the grain bin, and then they used that corn on their farm to feed livestock. So traditionally that was not weighed as it came into the farm. And as you think about today, well, we have many more large corporations, big commercial grain operations, our poultry operations, virtually all big commercial operations. A lot of our hog operations are in that category now, where it might even be possible for USDA to go out and talk to those big commercial interests about the bushels that are coming in, because they are buying and they are weighing those bushels as they come in. But that really is not done at this point. So what we have is the feed category is not measured. The other components like exports are measured and weighed out. the processors weigh and measure the amount they send through processing. So then this leaves us with this category called what's left over is feed and residual. So what residual means is that all of the errors in the balance sheet come into that residual category or come into the feed numbers. So if you have overestimations of the size of the crop from last year, then that comes in as a higher value, and that will show up as more feed and residual use. If you're mistaken and have too small of crop size, then you'll have a similar but opposite effect on your feed and residual category. Then you add to that all these changes we have seen recently in moving from feeding corn directly as a corn kernel, grinding that and putting it into livestock feed, to now the big shifting to distillers grains. So we're looking at about on a corn bushel equivalent, about 900 million bushels of distillers grains in corn bushel equivalents that we are now feeding. Now you add to that another change that's going on right now, and we see the dry mills, dry ethanol mills, which was primarily what we built starting back in 06 especially, and that big explosion of ethanol plants were virtually all dry mills. They're now going to fractionation, which essentially means they're going to try to get that seed into three components. The three components would be the seed coat, which is primarily a fiber product that certainly would work well in the dairy and the beef industry, but to get the seed coat off, heavy fiber. To get the germ or the embryo, the little white portion that is the new life in that seed separated, that's the heavy concentration of corn oil as well as protein in that area. And corn oil is currently selling for about 55 cents a pound, and distillers are selling for 10 cents a pound. So you can see if they can separate that out, get the really high-value oil and sell that for our human corn oil use, that can really increase potentially revenues for what comes out of that that seed. The third thing then, of course, is what you want for ethanol to ferment, and that's the starch. And so we have one of the major ethanol producers we were with a couple weeks ago, and they said they are estimating that 40% now of the dry mills are fractionating, where they have gone to trying to separate into three portions, and that will be 80% within 1 to 2 years. So this changes the mix of feed products again, where you get a high fiber product from the seed coat, you get a high protein product from the embryo after you extract the oil, and you then change the mix of what comes out of that starch. So when we say all we want to know is how much are we feeding, this is a really difficult time because we're going through so many changes. And you want to know so specifically because 200, 300 million bushels difference on that balance sheet, you know, that can be $1 or $2 a bushel on corn. So let me talk just a little bit with you. We'll try to break into some of that and talk a bit about what we see for the feeding side of this. And I think it's really reasonably optimistic on the livestock side. And as we think about what happened for the animal industries, I want to just talk a little bit about that. And then really to say the bottom line is the animal industries have gone through some enormous adjustments, and those adjustments now, they have largely gotten the prices of their animal products they sell. They've gotten those up to levels they can pay $6, $7 for corn. So those big adjustments have happened. It was a lot of trauma for a period of time, and I want to talk just a little bit about that. So, you know, you can't just double, triple, quadruple the price of things like corn for the animal industry without having a really major impact on those industries and major impacts on consumers in this country and around the world. As we look at what has happened since we had $2 corn, we see the consumption of meat in this country on a per capita basis, on a per person basis, has dropped 22 pounds per person per year. Now, we're about 220 pounds back in 2006, 2007, or the last years, I say. The animal industries were primarily influenced by $2 corn. Now, as you well know, by late 6 and 7, we'd already started corn prices going up, but the animal industry always lags. They were looking at the corn price back in 4 and 5 and early 6 for their production that was coming out in 6 and 7. So the actual number, 222 pounds of meat consumption per person back in the average 2006-2007, and that has dropped to 198 pounds for this year. So 24-pound reduction in the amount of meat that you and I eat per year. As you think about that, that's 10-11%. That probably would be noticeable. And if we had a show of hands and we said in this group, how many have you adjusted 10-11%? I don't know, but probably wouldn't have many of you that would say, yeah, I have really dropped back on my meat consumption substantially. But we look at the entire country, the entire United States. That is the number that we have. We have really seen the much higher prices at the retail level really cause consumers to have to cut back on average. And we think a lot of that is just smaller portion size. The second thing is substitution. So we are seeing, you know, some families that were eating steaks have had to move to hamburgers. Some that were eating hamburgers may have, stir fry with just little bits of meat in that really conserves the amount of meat. And clearly some that were already eating the stir fry or just little bits of meat have had to move to some meals that do not have meat in them at all. So how did that all happen? Well, that happened because the feed cost for the animal industry went up so dramatically. So you've heard a lot of this discussion that got into the food versus fuel discussion at least two different times in the last several years. 2008, that was the peak prices we saw on soybeans, up around $16, and a lot of discussion food versus fuel. And then again in 2011, about a year ago as we went into the spring and summer, as we got into the droughty, dry conditions and saw spiking up to record high prices on corn up in the $8 future range. So when we go back and look how did all this unwind for the livestock, the animal sector, the animal sector could not immediately pass along those higher prices of feed. Feed tends to be 50-60%, depending on species, of the total cost. So for most of you, that's even more than fertilizer. You know, it's substantially more as a percentage than fertilizer would be for you in the cropping operations. So what did livestock people do when suddenly they were selling their livestock for this price and their cost just went up sharply in terms of feed costs doubling, tripling? Well, the answer to that is, some of them probably went to their packers, their milk buyers, and they probably said, hey, my costs have gone up, so Mr. Packer, pay me more for my animals. To which the packer said, sorry, it doesn't work like that. You're a price taker. So when your costs go up substantially, you can't pass that on to your buyer. So the buyer offers the same price, and the producer simply must absorb those higher feed costs in their margins. So their margins obviously shrink, or as we saw in the case of basically all of our animal industries, negative margins, huge losses. Now those huge losses are kind of like the opposite of a thrill. You know, profits are a thrill, but sometimes they call losses inverse thrills. You know, you got to think about what's an inverse thrill. Okay, that's not hitting very well here. So, you know, things are really gone down. Things are really going down. And so that causes discouragement. So this results in reduction of production over time. And that reduction of production over time does what? It reduces the amount of supply in the market. And just like on farmland, if you reduce supply and demand stays the same, now we've also had a demand surge on farmland, but if you reduce supply, you're going to push those prices up. So what we have seen is over a period, especially of 2008, 2009, 2010, massive losses, huge equity losses, bankruptcies in the animal industries that got enough discouragement that they got their supplies adjusted downward. Now, as we think about what that did to price, as we look at beef cattle as an example, is the most dramatic reduction that we have. Looking at per capita supplies of beef this year, we're going to be down this year 17% of available beef supplies for each of us versus where we were the last of the $2 corn, and that is for the livestock influence 2006-2007 production. So massive reductions, and not only, of course, did the cattle industry have the very high feed prices, they also had the enormous drought in the southern plains that is still there in many areas, although parts of Texas and Oklahoma have gotten considerable amount of rain. So still a lot of drought conditions around the country, and that made the beef situation even worse. In terms of the pork sector, we're down about 7% less pork available for consumers here in the United States versus the last of the $2 corn-influenced animal production in 2006 and 2007. And the poultry production is about 5 to 7% less available in the United States. So there's where that 22 pounds is. We can go out and we can look how much beef, how much pork, how much chicken, how much turkey. And, of course, a lot of people ask the question, well, are we going to recover? Won't we come back? And to which I'd argue is, yes, we're going to come back some in terms of those per capita consumption numbers as availability increases. But basically, corn prices have to come down more for that livestock industry to really expand. What you have is you have the price of feed and the price of animal products to the consumer, those have relatively gone up relative to other things that people buy, like clothing and cars. So it is kind of a permanent shift, it looks like, if we keep corn prices high. And we're sort of using that $6 to $7 mark as saying if corn comes back below especially $6, you're going to see the livestock and animal industries in some expansion. On the other hand, if we see another round of corn prices going $7 to $8, you're going to have to see the animal industries cut back. So sort of the message in that is that there have been massive changes, that those industries have had to adjust, that today we believe the industries can pay in the $6 to $7, the animal industries can pay $6 to $7 for your corn, and that as long as you keep corn $6, the animal industries are not going to fuss. If you go above $7, they're going to start saying, oh my gosh, we have to cut back. And especially if you drop below $6, we will see them in some expansion. Now, there's a second factor that's really been helpful to us for the animal sector and to you as corn producers and as soybean producers, soybean meal. Again, the biggest use of soybean meal headed right to the animal industry. And that is just like you have had a big demand enhancement for soybean purchases from China in the last 5 or 6 years, the livestock sector has also had a demand, almost surge, I would say, in terms of exports of meat products to other countries. So kind of what's going on here in these last 5 years is that U.S. consumers have really got hit hard. They've really had to reduce their their consumption, as I said, by about 11% on a per capita basis. But the production in our industries, if you look at the size of production in the animal industries, versus 2006-2007, well, the per capita supplies of beef in the U.S. are down 17%. The size of production in the beef industry is only down 5%. So why is this? It is because foreign buyers have really found U.S. meats. And so we have seen a pretty rapid expansion on all of those meats. The beef sector has more than doubled exports over the last 5 years. The pork sector has increased about 60% their exports. And the poultry sector is around 20 to 25% expansion in exports. So again, one of the big demand categories we talk about is growing incomes in developing countries. Growing incomes in developing countries. So this has been very important on the soybean purchase side from China. But this is also important, it looks like, on meats. China is clearly one of the countries that has been buying more meat products from us. And in developing countries, when those incomes rise, they want more food, and they tend to want dietary transition from primarily a grain diet over to more meat, milk, and eggs. So one of the transitions that I think is positive for U.S. agriculture at this point is this, even with these much higher prices of live animals and retail prices, we're seeing those world consumers come in and say, we want more of that meat product. While we're really seeing the U.S. consumer probably simply not able to pay and compete with that demand out there in the world market. Now, when you put that together, there's kind of a saying that's been kicking around here for, the last year or two, China's going to eat your lunch. And this is a broader concept. It's a broader concept that there's a limited amount of resources on the earth, that when you have such strong demand from such a rapidly growing and large population base, that you begin to have a lot of competition for the resources and the products that are out there. You know, we look back to U.S. consumers, all of us in agriculture, and we've always taken great pride in the productivity, the low cost at which we could produce food, the benefit of providing food and nutrition to humanity so that humanity could be released to do the great things with their minds and their labor that make the world, we hope, a positive place and one that becomes more positive over time. So this is a new time period, if you will. We've really never seen a time where the world was so competitive for the resources that we have on our farms and the products that we have from our farms. So I think that remains a very strong positive. Let me just dig into these numbers a little bit as best that I could and say that when you put all these numbers together, so basically what we've said is that feed prices went up sharply, that the livestock industry had to cut back. They cut back, and that has really reduced per capita consumption in this country. But we've had a demand increase, a really helpful demand, a surge almost, I think, in demand for livestock products. That's so impressive that I'll just quote a few numbers to you. And that is of pork that we're producing this year, we're going to export 22% of the pork that's produced this year. If you go back 20 years ago, that was about 2% of the pork we were producing went into export, 22%. Broilers, we're going to be about 19% of the broilers that we produce in this country are going to go into the export market. And you know and I know and we have all spent, certainly me in my career, a lot of time trying to work on exports of grain. Exports of grain in the, especially even in the 60s, but especially the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, a lot of our policy was built around trying to get more and more grain exports. That was our salvation. We could produce so much more than we could consume here. We had to have that export market for it. If you look at corn exports this year, we'll export only about 15% of our corn. And that tells us we now have two livestock species, both pork as well as broilers, chicken, that we are exporting substantially more as a percent of our production than corn. To me, that is just a revelation of how changed our livestock industries have become in terms of much more export-focused, and how we have changed also through policy some of our preferences, as we particularly found the use of corn for ethanol, a domestic use that really has kept a lot of that corn here in this country. I think if you look around the world, you also see this sense around the world that feed prices are going to be higher, and that the United States does have this big ethanol industry, and that ethanol industry gives us distillers' grains, an all-feed product, and that this puts the U.S. in a more comparative advantage in producing more of the world's meat. Our animal industries are on top of that. The big growth markets at this point are not in the United States. As we've said, we have actually gone down in the total amount of consumption in the United States. The reason our industries have been able, animal industries, maintain themselves or even grow some over the last 5 years is because of that export market. So as we look at these numbers in terms of how much corn is going to go into these feeding categories, and again, you heard some of these references. One of the ways that USDA analysts try to sort this out, and by the way, you know, if Darrell Good at the University of Illinois can't get this sorted out, and then I look at the analysts that are with USDA, the Economic Research Service, that's where the economists go to do their work, the corn analyst, the soybean analyst, and the wheat analyst, the ones that head that up and responsibility, those were all trained at Purdue. So, I mean, if Illinois and Purdue doesn't have this figured out, it's not figure-outable. Is that a word? Figure-outable? I don't know if that's a word or not, but anyway, it is tough. So what they do is they try to put these animal numbers into what's called grain-consuming animal units. So it's trying to get into, and based on what will one dairy cow eat in a year, the amount of grain. So there's also high protein, grain-consuming animal units, and grain-consuming. So this is the corn-based. And as we look at this particular year that we're in right now, the feeding for this 11 crop that we're marking into 12, the grain-consuming animal units are up about one-half of 1%. So, you know, you'd say, okay, well, we're feeding more animals. Where does that come from? Cattle on feed, their numbers are up 2.8% on cattle on feed. For the amount we're going to feed in the 2011-12 marketing year versus the previous year. Hogs are up 1.5%. Dairy's up about 0.7%. It's the poultry. The poultry industry is down this year, down about 1.6%. So most of that up, but what we see there is, on average, it's about 0.5% more animals to feed. Okay, you immediately say, well, that means we're going to be using more corn in that feeding column. Well, we have to do some adjustments, and those adjustments are for things like the additional amount of wheat that we're going to feed this year. And so when we put these numbers in, you know, I've even kicked wheat feeding up another 20 million bushels of what, above what USDA has. Distillers' grains will be down a little bit this year because at least the USDA is expecting the amount of ethanol production, corn used for ethanol, to be down a little bit. So if we take that as their numbers, that would produce slightly less distillers' grains. That comes out about 900 million bushels of corn equivalent. But then we have major decreases in the sorghum crop. Remember, sorghum's out there in Texas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, parts of Kansas, devastated by that drought. And so the amount of sorghum to be fed, that is down this year, USDA numbers, from 125 million bushels of sorghum to 65 million bushels of sorghum. So we see when we put all these numbers together, what we're coming up with is, wait a minute, you got more animals to feed. that should take more of these feed grains and distillers, not less. And so we have this big drop, as you talked about here this morning, of 200 million bushels less feeding category. So how can that be? Well, when you dig into it, you find one of the things that happens is that in these years when we have really high corn prices, the feeding efficiency increases. The feeding efficiency, though, for this year would have to be 5% higher feed efficiency. And that is a very high increase in the efficiency level. And again, you know, people do increase efficiencies. They do adjust those feeders. They do do things to reduce the amount of feed usage. But again, that appears to be very high. So when I work through those numbers, what it tells me is I think it's the numbers seem reasonably convincing that, yes, that feed number could be very low. And as several of the panel members suggested, basically USDA is coming out with very low inventories. You can't go down to zero inventories. 800, as Dan suggested, may even be too low. That number is more like 900 or a billion. And so they're just allocating. They're just allocating, well, if we're going to be that low and we have that small of supply. So I think as sort of a concluding point, we'd say I think that remains friendly for this old crop corn. I think a second thing we'd have to say is that over time we're going to get a better grip on these numbers as we get the ethanol industry more grown out and more stabilized on the kind of feed products that they are producing. I'd also like to say that the animal industries lost a lot of money. They had a major reduction of equity. You think about the cropping sector, particularly land values, such a major increase in equity there. You had some numbers of equity loss in the livestock sector that were, you know, literally tens of billions of dollars. But that's behind us. They have made those adjustments. They can pay now, my estimate is this year, like on hog producers, they can pay $7 for corn. I run ethanol estimates. Ethanol plants, I estimated last week, could pay about $5.70 a bushel for corn to break even, and at least one representative of the animal industry can pay $7. So this is much different than we saw a couple of years ago, when break-evens for animal producers were $1 and $2 on corn because, you know, their prices were so bad, their costs were so high, losing so much money. They're fully competitive now, and what this means going forward is if you bring corn back below $6 a bushel, you're going to see some expansion, some recovery of those per capita numbers and expansion in the livestock sector. If we go higher, then they're going to have to make some cutbacks again. But the big transition has happened, and you got to remember the number one user of your corn and your soybean meal is what? That's the livestock and animal sector. So while the USDA category of corn kernels going to feed has dropped down below ethanol use, if you add back the distillers, we're on up there at 5.5 billion bushels versus about 5 billion going to the ethanol sector. When you add now the increasing exports that are going into the foreign market, more of your corn and more of your soybean meal going into animals produced right here, processed right here in the United States, many here in the Midwest, and then destined for those foreign markets. So I think that's overall a positive tone. It says we're getting growth, and those industries have made the big adjustments. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.